Granby nodded a little, his head bowed, and the next morning Jane came to Iskierka's clearing in great state, with all her medals and even her great plumed hat, which aviators scarcely wore, a gold-plated sabre and pistols on her belt. Granby had assembled all his new crew, and they saluted her with a great noise of arms, Iskierka nearly coiling herself into knots with excitement, and the ferals and even Temeraire peering over the trees to watch with interest.
"Well, Iskierka, your captain tells me that you are ready for service," Jane said, putting her hat under her arm to look sternly at the little Kazalik. "But what are these reports I hear of you, that you will not mind orders? We cannot send you into battle if you cannot follow orders."
"Oh, it is not true," Iskierka said. "I can follow orders as well as anyone. It is only no one will give me any good ones, and I am only told to sit and not to fight, and to eat three times a day. I do not want any more stupid cows," she added smoulderingly.
The ferals, hearing this translated for them by their own handful of officers, set up a low squabbling murmur of disbelief.
"It is not only the pleasant orders we must follow, but the tiresome ones as well," Jane said, when the noise had died down. "Do you suppose Captain Granby likes to be forever sitting in this clearing, waiting for you to grow more settled? Perhaps he would rather go back to service with Temeraire and have some fighting himself."
Iskierka's eyes went platter wide, and she hissed from all her spikes like a furnace. In an instant she had thrown a pair of jealous coils around Granby, which bid fair to boil him like a lobster in steam.
"He would not! You would not at all, would you?" she appealed to him. "I will fight just as well as Temeraire, I promise, and I will even obey the stupidest orders, at least if I may have some pleasant ones also," she qualified hastily.
"I'm sure she will mind better in future, sir,"
Granby managed himself, coughing, his hair already plastered down, soaking against his forehead and neck.
"Pray don't fret. I would never leave you, only I'm getting wet,"
he added plaintively to her. "Hm," Jane said, with an air of frowning consideration.
"Since Granby speaks for you, I suppose we will give you your chance," she said at last. "And here you may have your first orders, Captain, if she will let you come for them, and, to be sure, stand still for her harness."
Iskierka immediately let him loose, and stretched herself out for the ground crew, only craning her neck a little to see the red-sealed and yellow-tasseled packet, a formality often dispensed with in the corps, which directed them in very ornate and important language to do nothing more than run a quick hour's patrol down to Guernsey and back.
"And you may take her by that old heap of rubble left at Castle Cornet, where the gunpowder blew up the tower, and tell her it is a French outpost, so she may flame it from aloft,"
Jane added to Granby, in an undertone not meant for Iskierka's ears. Iskierka's harness was indeed a great deal of trouble to arrange, as the spines were placed quite randomly, and the frequent issuing of steam made her hide slick. An improvised collection of short straps and many buckles, wretchedly easy to tangle, and she could not entirely be blamed for growing tired of the process. But the promise of coming action and the observing crowd made her more patient. At length she was properly rigged out, and Granby, with relief, said,
"There, it is quite secure. Now try and see if you can shake any of it loose, dear one."
She writhed and beat her wings quite satisfactorily, twisting herself this way and that to inspect the harness.
"You are supposed to say, 'All lies well,' if you are comfortable,"
Temeraire whispered loudly to her, after she had been engaged in this sport for several minutes.
"Oh, I see,"
she said, and settling again, announced,
"All lies well. Now we shall go."
In this way she was at least a little reformed. No one would have called her temper obliging, certainly, and she invariably stretched her patrols farther afield than Granby would have them, in hopes of meeting some enemy more challenging than an abandoned old fortification or a couple of birds.
"But at least she will take a little training, and eats properly, which I call a victory for now," Granby said. "And after all, as much a fright she gives us, she'll give the frogs a worse. Lawrence, do you know, we talked to the fellows at Castle Cornet, and they set up a bit of sail for her. She can set it alight from 80 yards, twice the range of a flamme de gloire, and she can go at it for 5 minutes straight. I don't understand how she gets her breath while she is at it."
They had indeed some trouble in keeping her out of direct combat, for meanwhile the French were continuing their harassment and scouting of the coast with ever-increasing aggression. Jane used the sick dragons more heavily for patrol to spare Temeraire and the ferals,
They instead sat most of the day waiting on the cliffs for one warning flare or another to go up, or listening with pricked ears for the report of a signal gun, before they dashed frantically to meet another incursion. In the space of 2 weeks, Temeraire skirmished 4 times more with small groups, and once Arcady and a few of his band, sent experimentally on patrol by themselves while Temeraire snatched a few more hours of sleep, just barely turned back a Pou de Ciel who had daringly tried to slip past the shore batteries at Dover, less than a mile from a clear view of the quarantine grounds. The Ferrols came back from their narrow but solitary victory delighted with themselves, and Jane, with quick cleverness, took the occasion to present Arcady ceremonially with a long length of chain. Almost worthless, being made only of brass, with a large dinner plate inscribed with his name for a medal, but polished to a fine golden shine, and rendering Arcady for once speechless with amazement, as it was fastened about his neck. For only a moment. Then he burst forth in floods of carolling joy, and insisted on having every single one of his fellows inspect his prize. Nor did Temeraire escape this fate. He indeed grew a little bristling, and withdrew in dignity to his own clearing to polish his breastplate more vigorously than usual.
"You cannot compare the two," Lawrence said cautiously. "It is only a trinket to make him complacent, and encourage them in their efforts."
"Oh, certainly," Temeraire said very haughty. "Mine is much nicer. I do not in the least want anything so common as brass."
After a moment he added, muttering,
"But his is very large."
"Cheap at the price," Jane said the next day, when Lawrence came to report on a morning for once uneventful, the Ferrols more zealous than ever and rather disappointed not to find more enemies than the reverse.
"They come along handsomely, just as we had hoped."
But she spoke tiredly. Looking into her face, Lawrence poured her a small glass of brandy and brought it to her at the window, where she was standing to look out at the Ferrols, presently cavorting in mid-air over their clearing after their dinner.
"Thank you, I will."
She took the glass, but did not drink at once.
"Contarinus has gone," she said abruptly. "The first long wing we have lost. It was a bloody business."
She sat down altogether, very heavily, and put her head forward.
"He took a bad chill and suffered a hemorrhage in the lungs, the surgeons tell me. At any rate, he could not stop coughing, and so his acid came and came. It began at last to build up on the spurs and sear his own skin. It laid his jaw bare to the bone." She paused. "Gardenley shot him this morning."
Lawrence took the chair beside her, feeling wholly inadequate to the task of offering any comfort. After a little while she drank the brandy and set down her glass, and turned back to the maps to discuss the next day's patrolling. He went away from her, ashamed of his dread of the party, now only a few days hence, and determined to put himself forward with no regard for his own mortification, if for the least chance of improving the conditions of the sick.
"And I hope you will permit me to suggest," Wilberforce wrote, "that any oriental touch to your wardrobe, only a little one which might at a glance set you apart, would be most useful. I am happy to report that we have engaged some Chinese as servants for the evening, by offering a good sum in the ports, where occasionally a few of them may be found having taken service on an East Indiaman. They are not properly trained, of course, but they will only be carrying dishes to and from the kitchens, and we have instructed them most severely to show no alarm at being in the presence of the dragon, which I hope they have understood. However, I do have some anxiety as to their comprehension of what faces them, and should you have enough liberty to come early, that we may try their fortitude, it would be just as well."
Lawrence did not indulge in sighs. He folded the letter, sent his Chinese coat to his tailor's for refurbishment, and asked Jane for permission to go some hours earlier. In the event, the Chinese servants did set up a great commotion on their arrival, but only by leaving all their work and running to prostrate themselves before Temeraire, nearly throwing themselves beneath his feet in their efforts to make the show of respect generally considered due a celestial, as symbolic of the imperial family. The British workmen engaged in the final decoration of the covert were not nearly so complacent, and vanished, one and all, leaving the great panels of embroidered silk, surely made at vast expense, hanging half askew from the tree branches and dragging upon the earth. Wilberforce exclaimed in dismay as he came to greet Lawrence, but Temeraire issued instructions to the Chinese servants, who set to work with great energy, and with the assistance of the crew the covert was a handsome, if astonishing, sight in time to receive the guests, with brass lamps tied makeshift onto branches to stand in place of Chinese paper lanterns, and small coal stoves placed at intervals along the tables.
"We may bring the business off, if only it will not come on to snow,"
Lord Allendale said pessimistically, arriving early to inspect the arrangements.
"It is a pity your mother could not be here,"
he added.
"But the child has not yet come, and she does not like to leave Elizabeth in her confinement,"
referring to the wife of Lawrence's eldest brother, soon to present him with his fifth. The night stayed clear, if cold, and the guests began to arrive in cautious dribs and drabs, keeping well away from Temeraire, who was ensconced in his clearing at the far end of the long tables, and peering at him not very surreptitiously through opera-glasses. Lawrence's officers were all meanwhile standing by him, stiff and equally terrified in their best coats and trousers. All new, fortunately, Lawrence having taken the trouble to direct his officers to the better tailors in Dover, and funding himself the necessary repairs which all their wardrobes had required after their long sojourn abroad. Emily was the only one of them pleased, as she had acquired her first silk gown for the occasion, and if she tripped upon the hem a little she did not seem to mind, rather exultant in her kid gloves and a string of pearls which Jane had bestowed upon her. "It is late enough in conscience for her to be learning how to manage skirts," Jane said. "Do not fret, Lawrence. I promise you no one will be suspicious. I have made a cake of myself in public a dozen times, and no one ever thought me an aviator for it. But if it gives you any comfort, you may tell them she is your niece."
"I may do no such thing. My father will be there, and I assure you he is thoroughly aware of all his grandchildren,"
Lawrence said. He did not tell her that his father would immediately conclude Emily to be his own natural-born child should he make such a false claim, but only privately decided he should keep Emily close by Temeraire's side, where she would be little seen. He had been in no doubt that his guests would keep a very good distance, whatever persuasion Mr. Wilberforce intended to apply. That persuasion, however, took the most undesirable form, Mr. Wilberforce saying, "Come, behold this young girl here, who thinks nothing of standing in reach of the dragon. If you can permit yourself, madam, to be outdone by trained aviators, I hope you will not allow a child to outstrip you." While Lawrence, with sinking heart, observed his father turning to cast an astonished eye on Emily, which confirmed all his worst fears. Lord Allendale did not scruple either to approach and interrogate her. Emily, perfectly innocent of malice, answered in her clear, girlish voice,
"Oh, I have lessons every day, sir, from the captain, although it is Temeraire who gives me my mathematics now, as Captain Lawrence does not like the calculus. But I had rather practice fencing," she added candidly,
and looked a little uncertain when she found herself laughed over, and pronounced a dear by the pair of society ladies who had been persuaded to venture close to the great table by her example.
"A masterful stroke, Captain!" Wilberforce murmured softly. "Wherever did you find her?"
And did not wait for an answer before he accosted a few gentlemen who had risked coming near, and worked upon them in the same fashion, adding to his persuasions that if Lady So-and-so had approached Temeraire, surely they could not show themselves hesitant. Temeraire was very interested in all the guests, particularly admiring the more bejewelled of the ladies, and managed by accident to please the Marchioness of Carstoke, a lady of advanced years and receding neckline, whose bosom was concealed only by a vulgar set of emeralds in gold, by informing her she looked a good deal more the part in his estimation than the Queen of Prussia, whom he had only seen in travelling clothes. Several gentlemen challenged him to perform simple sums. He blinked a little, and, having given them the answers, inquired whether this was a sort of game performed at parties, and whether he ought to offer them a mathematical problem in return.
"Dyer, pray bring me my sand-table," he said,
and when this was arranged he sketched out with his claw a small diagram for purposes of setting them a question on the Pythagorean theorem, sufficient to baffle most of the attending gentlemen whose own mathematical skills did not extend past the card-tables.
"But it is a very simple exercise,"
Temeraire said in some confusion, wondering aloud to Lawrence if he had missed some sort of joke, until at last a gentleman, a member of the Royal Society, on a quest to observe for himself certain aspects of celestial anatomy, was able to solve the puzzle. When Temeraire had audibly spoken to the servants in Chinese, and conversed in fluent French with several of the guests, and had failed to eat or crush anyone, increasing fascination began at last to trump fear and draw more of the company towards him. Lawrence shortly found himself quite neglected as of considerably less interest, a circumstance which would have delighted him if only it had not left him subject to awkward conversation with his father, who inquired stiltedly about Emily's mother. Questions whose evasion would only have made Lawrence seem the more guilty, and yet whose perfectly truthful answers, that Emily was the natural-born daughter of a Jane Rowland, a gentlewoman living in Dover and whose education he had taken as his charge, left entirely the wrong impression, which Lawrence could no more correct than his father would outright ask.
"She's a pretty behaved girl for her station in life, and I hope she does not want for anything,"
Lord Allendale said in a sort of sidling way.
"I am sure if there was any difficulty in finding her a respectable situation, when she is grown, your mother and I would be glad to be of assistance."
Lawrence did his best to make it clear that this handsome offer was unnecessary, in some desperation turning to a lie of omission, saying,
"She has friends, sir, as must prevent her ever being in real distress. I believe there is already some arrangement made for her future."
He gave no details, and his father, his sense of propriety satisfied, did not inquire further. Fortunate, as that arrangement, military service in the corps, would hardly have recommended itself to Lord Allendale. The bleak notion came to Lawrence only afterwards that if Exidium were to die, Emily should have no dragon to inherit, and thus no assured post. Though a handful of long-wing eggs were presently being tended at Lochlagan, there were more women serving in the corps than would be needed to satisfy these new hatchlings. He made his escape, saying he saw Wilberforce beckoning him over. That gentleman indeed welcomed his company, if he had not immediately been soliciting it, and took hold of Lawrence's arm to guide him through the crowd and introduce him to all his prodigious acquaintance, amongst the curiously mingled attendants. Many had come merely to be entertained, and for the sensation of seeing a dragon, or more honestly, for the right to say they had done so, a substantial number of these being gentlemen of fashion, come already from heavy drinking, whose conversation would have made the noise impenetrable in a smaller space. Those ladies and gentlemen active in the abolition movement or evangelical causes were easily distinguished by their markedly more sober appearance, both in dress and mien. The tracts which they were giving out were ending largely upon the ground, and being trodden into the dirt. There were also a great many patriots, whether from real feeling or the desire to attach their names to a subscription list with the word Trafalgar upon it, as Wilberforce had arranged it should be published in the newspapers, and not inclined to be quibbling over whether those veterans were men or dragons. The political range was thoroughly represented, therefore, and more than one heated discussion had broken out with the lubrications of liquor and enthusiasm. One stout and red-faced gentleman, identified by Wilberforce as a member from Bristol, was declaring to a pale and fervent young lady trying to give him a tract that,
"It is all nonsense. The passage is perfectly healthy, for it is in the interest of the traders to preserve their goods. It is as good a thing as ever will happen to a black to be taken to a Christian land where he may lose his heathen religion and be converted. That is excellent grounds, sir, for importing the gospel to Africa. It does less well to excuse the behaviour of Christian men in tearing away the Africans from their homes for profit," he was answered, not by the lady, but by a black gentleman who had been standing a little behind her and assisting her in giving out the pamphlets. A narrow, raised scar, the thickness of a leather strap, ran down the side of his face, and the edges of ridged bands of scar tissue protruded past the ends of his sleeves, paler pink against his very dark skin. The gentleman from Bristol perhaps had not quite that brazen character which would have permitted him to defend the trade in the face of one of its victims. He chose rather to retreat behind an expression of offended hauteur at having been addressed without introduction, and would have turned aside without reply. But Wilberforce leaned forward and said with gentle malice,
"Pray, Mr. Bathurst, allow me to present you the Reverend Josiah Erasmus, lately of Jamaica."
Erasmus bowed. Bathurst gave a short, jerking nod, and cravenly quitted the field, with an excuse too muttered to be intelligible. Erasmus was an evangelical minister.
"And I hope a missionary soon," he added, shaking Lawrence's hand. "Back to my native continent.
whence he had been taken, a boy of 6 years of age, to suffer through that aforementioned healthy passage, chained ankles and wrists to his neighbours in a space scarcely large enough to lie down in.
"It was not at all pleasant to be chained,"
Temeraire said very low, when Erasmus had been presented him,
"and I knew at least they would be taken off when the storm had finished. Anyway, I am sure I could have broken them."
Those chains of which he spoke indeed had been for his own protection, to keep him secured to the deck through a 3 days' typhoon. But the occasion had come close on the heels of his witnessing the brutal treatment of a party of slaves at the port of Cape Coast, and had left an indelible impression. Erasmus said simply,
"So did some of our number. The fetters were not well made, but they had nowhere to go but to throw themselves on the mercy of the sharks. We had not wings to fly."
He spoke without the rancour for which he might have been pardoned, and when Temeraire had expressed, darkly, the wish that the slavers might have been thrown overboard instead, Erasmus shook his head.
"Evil should not be returned for evil," he said. "Their judgment belongs to the Lord. My answer to their crimes will be to return to my fellows with a word of God, and I hope that the practice cannot long continue when we are all brothers in Christ, so that the slaver and his prey will both be saved."
Temeraire was dubious of this most Christian speech, and after Erasmus had left them, muttered,
"I would not give a fig for the slavers myself, and God ought to judge them more quickly."
A blasphemous remark which made Lawrence blanch, lest Wilberforce should have overheard. But his attention was fortunately elsewhere at present, on a growing noise at the far end of the long clearing where a crowd was gathering.
"I wonder he should have come," Wilberforce said.
It was Nelson himself, who had entered the clearing in the company of several friends, some of them naval officers of Lawrence's acquaintance, and was presently paying his respects to Lord Allendale.
"Of course we did not omit an invitation, but I had no real expectation, perhaps because it was sent in your name. Forgive me, I will take myself off a while. I'm happy enough to have him come and lend his reflected glow to our party, but he has said too much in public for me to converse easily with him."
Lawrence was better pleased, for his own part, to find Nelson not offended in the least at whatever whispers and comparisons had been put about between them. That gentleman was rather as amiable as anyone could wish, offering his good hand.
"William Lawrence, you've gone a long way since we last met. I think we were at dinner together on the Vanguard in 98 before Aboukir Bay. How very long ago, and how short a time it seems."
"Indeed, sir, and I am honoured your grace should remember,"
Lawrence said, and at his request rather anxiously took him back to be presented to Temeraire, adding when Temeraire's ruff ominously unfurled at the name,
"I hope you will make his grace most welcome, my dear. It is very kind of him to come and be our guest."
Temeraire, never very tactful, was unfortunately not to be warned by so subtle a hint, and rather coldly asked,
"What has happened to your medals? They are all quite misshapen."
This he certainly meant as a species of insult. However, Nelson, who famously preferred only to win more glory than to speak of what he already had gained, could not have been better pleased at the excuse to discuss the battle, told over so thoroughly by the public before ever he had risen from his injuries, with an audience for once innocent of the details.
"Why, a rascal of a Spanish fire-breather gave us a little trouble at Trafalgar, and they were caught in the flame," he said, taking one of the ample number of vacant chairs at the table nearby and arranging bread rolls for the ships.
Temeraire, growing interested despite himself, leaned in closely to observe their manoeuvres on the cloth. Nelson did not flinch back in the least, though the onlookers who had gathered to observe took, nearly all of them, several steps back. He described the Spanish dragon's passes with a fork and much lurid detail, and further rescued his character in Temeraire's eyes by concluding,
"And very sorry I am that we did not have you there. I am sure you should have had no trouble in running the creature off."
"Well, I am sure, too,"
Temeraire said candidly, and peered at the medals again with more admiration.
"But would the Admiralty not give you fresh ones? That is not very handsome of them."
"Why, I consider these a better badge of honour, dear creature, and I have not applied for replacement,"
Nelson said.
"Now, Lawrence, do I recall correctly? Can I possibly have read a report in the Gazette that this very dragon of yours lately sank a French ship called the Valérie, I believe, and in a single pass?"
"Yes, sir. I believe Captain Riley of the Allegiance sent in his report last year,"
Lawrence said uneasily. That report had rather understated the incident, and while he was proud of Temeraire's ability, it was not the sort of thing he thought civilian guests would find reassuring. Still less so should any of them learn that the French, too, now had their own celestial, and that the same dreadful power might be turned against their own shipping.
"Astonishing! Quite prodigious!" Nelson said. "What was she, a sloop of war?"
"A frigate, sir,"
Lawrence answered, even more reluctantly.
48 guns."
There was a pause.
"I cannot be sorry, although it was hard on the poor sailors," Temeraire said into the silence. "But it was not very noble of them, stealing upon us during the night when their dragon could see in the dark and I could not."
"Certainly,"
Nelson said, over a certain murmur from the assembled company. He, having recovered from his surprise, had rather a quick, martial gleam in his eye.
"Certainly, I congratulate you. I think I must have some conversation with the Admiralty Captain on your present station. You are on coastline duty at present, am I not correct? A waste, an unconscionable waste. You may be sure they will hear from me on the subject. Do you suppose he could manage as much on a ship of the line?"
Lawrence could not explain the impossibility of a change in their assignment without revealing the secret, so he answered a little vaguely, with gratitude for his Grace's interest.
"Very clever," Lord Allendale said grimly,
in conference with them and Wilberforce when Nelson had gone away again, nodding his farewells in the most affable manner to all who sought his attention.
"I suppose we must consider it a badge of success that he should prefer to send you away."
"Sir, I believe you are mistaken. I cannot allow his motives on this matter to be other than sincere in wishing the best use made of Temeraire's abilities,"
Lawrence said stiffly.
"It is very boring, always going up and down the coast," Temeraire put in, "and I should much rather have some more interesting work, like fighting fire-breathers, if we were not needed where we are. But I suppose we must do our duty,"
he finished, not a trifle wistfully, and turned his attention back to the other guests, who were all the more eager to speak with him now in imitation of Nelson's example. The party, most assuredly, a success.
"Lawrence, may we fly over the quarantine grounds as we go and see how comes the pavilion?"
Temeraire asked the next morning, as they made ready for the flight back to Dover.
"It will not be very far advanced," Lawrence said.
Temeraire's ulterior motive, to look into the quarantine grounds to see Maximus and Lily, was tolerably transparent. There had been no reply to the letters which Lawrence had sent, either to them or to their captains, and Temeraire had begun to inquire after them with increasing impatience. Lawrence feared Temeraire's likely reaction to seeing them so reduced by illness as he supposed them to be, but could think of no very good reason with which to divert him.
"But I should like to see it in all its stages," Temeraire said, "and if they have made any mistakes, we ought to correct it early, surely,"
he finished triumphantly, with the air of having hit upon an unanswerable justification.
"Is there any reason to fear infection in the air?" Lawrence asked Dorset quietly, aside. "Will there be a danger to flying over the grounds?"
"No, so long as he keeps a good distance from any of the sick beasts. It is certainly the phlegmatic humours which carry the infection. So long as he does not put himself directly in the way of a sneeze or a cough, I cannot think the danger substantial. Not aloft,"
Dorset said absently, without much consideration to the question, which did not fill Lawrence with great confidence. But he settled for extracting a promise that Temeraire should stay well aloft, where perhaps he might not see the worst of the ravages which had been inflicted on his friends, nor approach any dragon in the air.
"Of course I promise," Temeraire said, adding unconvincingly, "I only want to see the pavilion after all. It is nothing to me if we see any other dragons."
"You must be sure, my dear, or Mr. Dorset will not countenance our visit. We must not disturb the sick dragons who require their rest,"
Lawrence said, resorting to stratagem, which at last won Temeraire's sighs and agreement. Lawrence did not truly expect to see any dragons aloft. The ill beasts only rarely left the ground any more for the brief, showy patrols which Jane continued to use to keep up their illusion of strength for the French. The day was cloudy and drear, and as they flew towards the coast, they met a thin misting of rain blowing in from the channel. The exertion surely would not be asked of the sick dragons. The quarantine grounds were inland of Dover itself, the borders marked off by smoking torches and large red flags planted into the ground. low, deserted, rolling meadows, the dragons scattered about with little cover even from the wind, which snapped all the flags out crisply and made them all huddle down small to escape. But as Temeraire drew near the prescribed territory, Lawrence saw three specks increasing rapidly into three dragons, aloft, and flying energetically, two on the heels of a much smaller third. Temeraire said,
"Lawrence, that is Auctoritas, and Califera from Dover, I am sure of it, but I do not know that other little dragon at all. I have never seen one of that kind."
"Oh, hell, that is a plan vite," Ferris said, after a single borrowed look through Lawrence's glass. The three dragons were directly over the quarantine grounds, and the great miserable hulks of other sick beasts were plainly visible for the French dragon to see, even through the mist in all their blood-stained dirt, and already the two dragons who had attempted to halt her were falling off the pace and drooping earthwards, exhausted, as the tiny French dragon darted and looped and evaded, beating her wings mightily, and flung herself past the borders of the grounds, heading towards the channel as quick as ever she could go.
"After her, Temeraire," Lawrence said,
and they leapt into pursuit, Temeraire's enormous wings beating once to every five of hers, but eating up the yards with every stroke.
"They haven't much endurance. They're close couriers only, for all they're fast as bloody lightning. They must have brought her nearly up to the coast by boat at night to save her strength for the flight back,"
Ferris said, shouting over the knife-cut wind. Lawrence only nodded to save his voice. Bonaparte had likely been hoping to slip so small a messenger beast through where the larger had not been able to manage. He raised the speaking trumpet and bellowed,
"Rendezvous!"
to no effect. The flare they fired off for emphasis, launched ahead of the little dragon's nose, was a signal less easily missed or misinterpreted, but there was no slackening in the furious pace. The plan vite had only a small pilot, a young boy scarcely much older than Roland or Dyer, whose pale and frightened face Lawrence could plainly see in his glass as the boy looked back to see the vast black-winged pursuit ready to engulf him. He turned back to speak encouragement to his beast, casting off bits of harness and buckle as she flew. The boy even kicked off his shoes and threw overboard his belt with its sword and pistol, flashing in the sunlight as they turned end over end, surely prized treasures. And heartened by her rider's example, with an effort the little dragon began to speed her strokes and pull away, her advantage in speed and small breadth before the wind telling.
"We must bring her down,"
Lawrence said grimly, lowering his glass. He had seen what effect the divine wind had on enemy dragons of fighting weight and on soldiers under arms. What damage it might wreak upon so small and helpless a target he neither liked to think nor wished to witness. But their duty was plain.
"Temeraire, you must stop them. We cannot let them slip away."
"Lawrence, she is so very little,"
Temeraire objected unhappily, turning his head only just enough to be heard. He was still pressing on after her, with all the will in the world, but she would not be caught.
"We cannot try to board her," Lawrence answered. "She is too small and too quick. It would be a death sentence to make any man attempt that leap. If she will not surrender, she must be brought down. She is pulling away. It must be now."
Temeraire shuddered, then with decision drew breath and roared out, but over the French dragon, not directly at her. She gave a startled, shrill cry of alarm, back winging as if she was trying to reverse her course, her pace dropping off to nothing for a moment. With a convulsive, gathered lunge, Temeraire was above her and folding his wings, bearing her bodily down towards the earth below. Soft, pale yellow sand heaped in rolling dunes, and the little French dragon went tumbling pell-mell as they ploughed into the dirt behind her, oceanic waves of dust billowing up in a cloud around them. They slid across the ground some 100 yards, Lawrence blind and trying to shield his mouth from the flying sand, hearing Temeraire hissing in displeasure and the French dragon squalling. Then,
"Ha!" Temeraire said triumphantly. "Je vous ai attrapé. Il ne faut pas pleurer. Oh, I beg your pardon, I am very sorry."
And Lawrence wiped the grit from his face and nostrils, coughing violently and clearing his stinging vision, found himself looking almost directly into the alarming, fiery orange of a long-wing's slit-pupilled eye. Exidium turned his head to sneeze, acid droplets spraying involuntarily with a gesture, smoking briefly as the sand absorbed them. Lawrence gazed in horror as the great head swung wearily back, and Exidium said in a harsh and rasping voice,
"What have you done? You ought not have come here."
While the sand cloud settled to show him one among a half a dozen long wings, Lily raising her head out of her shielding wing beside him, all of them huddled close in the sand pit that was their place of quarantine. Chapter 5. They had no companion in their isolated quarantine meadow but little Sauvignon, the French courier-beast, who had not even the solace of her captain's presence. He, poor child, had been marched away in irons against her good behaviour, while she made piteous cries under the restraint of Temeraire's reluctant but irresistible hold upon her back, his great claw nearly pinning her to the ground entirely. She huddled upon herself after he was gone, and was only gradually persuaded by Temeraire to eat a little, and then to talk.
"Voici un joli cochon," Temeraire said,
nudging over one of the spit-roasted hogs which Gong Su had prepared for him, lacquered in dark orange sauce.
"Votre capitaine s'inquiétera s'il apprend que vous ne mangez pas vraiment."
She took a few bites, shortly proceeding to greater enthusiasm once Temeraire had explained to her that the recipe was
à la chinoise.
Her naive remark that she was eating
comme la reine blanche,
and a little more conversation confirmed to Lawrence that Long Tien Lien, their bitter enemy, was now securely established in Paris and deep in Napoleon's councils. The little courier, full of hero worship for the other celestial, was not to be led into exposing any secret plans, if she knew of any, but Lawrence needed no revelations to tell him that Lien's voice was sure to be loud for invasion, if Napoleon required any additional persuasion, and that she would strive to keep his attention firmly fixed upon Britain and no other part of the world.
"She says Napoleon is having the streets widened, so Lien may walk through all the city," Temeraire said, disgruntled. "And he has already built her a pavilion beside his palace. It does not seem fair that we have such difficulties here, when she has everything her own way."
Lawrence answered only dully. He cared very little any more for such larger affairs, when he was to watch Temeraire die as a Victoriatus had died, reduced to that hideous, bloody wreckage, a devastation far more complete than any Lien might have engineered from the deepest wells of malice.
"You were with them only a few moments. Let us hope," Jane had said.
But no more than that, and in her lack of encouragement Lawrence saw Temeraire's death warrant signed and sealed. All the sandpit was surely thick with the contagion. The long wings had been penned up there for the better part of a year, the effluvia buried in the sand along with their poisonous acid. He understood, belatedly, why he had seen none of his former colleagues, why Barclay and Harcourt had not answered his letters. Granby came to visit him, once. They could neither of them manage more than half a dozen words, painfully stilted. Granby consciously avoiding the subject of his own healthy ischiaca, and Lawrence not wishing in the least to speak of Temeraire's chances, especially not where Temeraire himself might hear, and learn to share his own despair. At present, Temeraire had no concern for himself, secure in the confidence of his own strength, a comfort which Lawrence had no desire to take from him before the inevitable course of the disease should manage the job.
"Je ne me sens pas bien,"
Sauvignon said, on the morning of the fourth day, waking herself and them with a violent burst of sneezing. She was taken away to join the other sick beasts, leaving them to wait alone for the first herald of disease. Jane had come to see him daily, with encouraging words as long as he wished to hear them, and brandy for when he could no longer. But she reluctantly said, coming to see him on the unhappy day,
"I am damned sorry to speak of this so bluntly, Lawrence, but you must forgive me. Would Temeraire have begun to think of breeding yet, do you know?"
"Breeding?"
Lawrence said bitterly, and looked away. It was natural, of course, that they should wish to preserve the bloodline of the rarest of all breeds, acquired with such difficulty, and now also in the possession of their enemy. Yet to him it could be only a desire to replace what should be irreplaceable.
"I know," she said gently, "but we must expect it to come on him any day now, and mostly they are disinclined once they get sick. And who can blame them?"
Her courage reproached him. She suffered as much herself with no outward show, and he could not yield to his own feelings before her. In any case, there was no shading of the truth to be had. He could not lie, and was forced to confess that Temeraire had grown very fond of a female imperial in the retinue of the Emperor while we were in Peking.
"Well, I am glad to hear it. I must ask if he would oblige us with a mating to begin as soon as tonight, now he has been without question exposed,"
Jane said.
"Felicita is not very poorly, and informed her captain 2 days ago that she thinks she has another egg in her. She has already given us 2, good creature, before she fell sick. She is only a yellow reaper, a middleweight. It is not the sort of cross any breeder of sense would choose to make, but I think any celestial blood must be better than none, and we have few enough who are in any state to bear."
"But I have never seen her in my life," Temeraire said, puzzledly, when the question was put to him. "Why should I wish to mate with her?"
"It is akin to an arranged marriage of state, I suppose,"
Lawrence said, uncertain how to answer. It seemed to him belatedly a coarse sort of proposal, as though Temeraire were a prize stallion to be set on to a mare. Neither of their preferences consulted, and not even a prior meeting.
"You need do nothing you do not like,"
he added abruptly. He would not see this forced on Temeraire in the least, any more than he should have lent himself to such an enterprise.
"Well, it is not as though I expect I would mind," Temeraire said, "if she would like it so very much. And I am rather bored only sitting about all day," he added, with rather less modesty than candour. "Only I do not understand at all why she should."
Jane laughed when Lawrence had brought her this answer, and went out to the clearing and explained,
"She would like to have an egg from you, Temeraire."
"Oh!"
Temeraire immediately puffed out his chest deeply in gratification, his ruff coming up, and with a gracious air bowed his head.
"Then certainly I will oblige her,"
he declared, and as soon as Jane had gone demanded that he be washed and his Chinese talon sheaths, stored away as impractical for regular use, be brought out and put on him.
"She is so damned happy to be of use I could weep,"
said Felicitas' captain, Broden, a dark-haired Welshman not many years older than Lawrence, with a craggy face which looked made for the grim and brooding lines into which it had presently settled. They had left the 2 dragons outside in Felicitas' clearing to arrange the matter to their own liking, which by the sound they were doing with great enthusiasm, despite the difficulties which ought to have been inherent in managing relations between 2 dragons of such disparate size.
"And I know I have nothing to complain of,"
he added bitterly. "She does better than 9/10 of the corps, and the surgeons think she will last 10 years at this rate of progress." He poured out an ample measure of wine and left the bottle on the table between them, with a second and third waiting. They did not speak much, but sat drinking together into the night, drooping gradually lower over their cups until the dragons fell quiet, and the shuddering aspen trees went still. Lawrence was not quite sleeping, but he could not think of moving or even to lift his head, weighted with a thick, smothering stupor like a blanket, all the world and time dulled away. Broden stirred him awake in his chair in the small hours of the morning.
"We will see you again tonight?"
he asked tiredly, as Lawrence stood and bent back his shoulders to crack the angry muscles loose.
"Best so, as I understand it,"
Lawrence said, looking at his hands in vague surprise. They trembled. He went out to collect Temeraire, whose profoundly smug and indecorous satisfaction might have put him to the blush, were he disposed to be in any way critical of what pleasures Temeraire might enjoy under the present circumstances.
"She has already had 2, Lawrence," Temeraire said,
laying himself back down to sleep in his own clearing, drowsy but jubilant.
"And she is quite sure she will have another. She said she could not tell at all that it was the first time I had sired."
"But is it?"
Lawrence asked, feeling slow and stupid.
"Did not you and May?"
Belatedly, the nature of the question stopped him.
"That had nothing to do with eggs," Temeraire said dismissively. "It is quite different."
And coiling his tail neatly around himself, went to sleep, leaving Lawrence all the more confused, as he could not dream of prying further. They repeated the visit the following evening. Lawrence looked at the bottle and did not take it up again, but with an effort engaged Broden upon other things— the customs of the Chinese and the Turks, and their sea journey to China, the campaign in Prussia and the great battle of Jena, which he could recreate in considerable detail, having observed the whole cataclysm from Temeraire's back. This was not, perhaps, the best means for relieving anxiety. When he had laid out all that whirling offensive, and the solid massed ranks of the Prussian army, in the form of walnut shells, were swept clean from the table, he and Brodin sat back and looked at one another. And then Brodin stood restlessly up and paced his small cabin.
"I would as soon he came across while some of us can still fight. If only I could give him more than ninepence for our chances if he did."
It was a dreadful thing to hope for an invasion, with unspoken the suggestion of a desire to be killed in one. Perilously close, Lawrence felt uneasily, to mortal sin, an extreme of selfishness, even if it did not mean that England would be laid bare after, and he was troubled to find a sympathetic instinct in himself.
"We must not speak so. They do not fear their own deaths, and God forbid that we should teach them to do so, or show less courage than they themselves do."
"Do you think they do not learn fear by the end?"
Brodin laughed unpleasantly and short.
"Of Vasaria scarcely knew London by the end, and he took her out of the shell with his own hands. She could only cry for water and for rest, and he could give her none. You may think me a heathen dog if you like. I would thank God, or Bonaparte, or the black devil himself for giving her a clean death in battle."
He poured the bottle, and when he was finished, Lawrence reached for it across the table.
"The breeders prefer 2 weeks," Jane said. "But we will be glad for as long as he feels himself up to the task."
So Lawrence dragged himself from his bed the next day, his sleep gone all to pieces, taken half in wine at Brodin's table and half during the early hours of the morning, and crept through his day, supervising the useless harness work and lessons for Emily and Dyer until it was time to go again. They repeated the engagement twice more, and then on the fifth day, while he sat lumpen and considering the chessboard dully, Brodin raised his head and said to Lawrence abruptly,
"Has he not yet begun to cough?"
"Perhaps my throat is a little sore," Temeraire said judiciously.
Lawrence was sitting, his head bent nearly to his knees, scarcely able to support the weight of hope resting so unexpectedly upon his shoulders, while Keynes and Dorset clambered over Temeraire like monkeys. They had listened to his lungs with a great paper cone placed against the chest, to which they put their ears, and stuck their heads in his jaws to examine his tongue, which remained a healthy and unspotted red.
"We must cup him, I think," Keynes said at last, turning to his medical satchel. "But I am perfectly well," Temeraire observed, sidling away from the approach of the wicked, curved blade of the catling. "It does not seem to me that one ought to be forced to take medicine when one is not sick. Anyone would think you had no other work to do," he said, aggrieved.
And the operation was only achieved by persuading him of the noble service which it should be to the sick dragons. It yet required a dozen attempts. He kept withdrawing his leg at the last moment until Lawrence convinced him not to look, but to keep his eyes turned in quite the opposite direction until the ready basin held by Dorset was filled, and Keynes said,
"There!"
and clapped the quartery, waiting ready in the fire, to the nick at once. They would have carried the steaming bowl full of dark blood away without another word if Lawrence had not chased after them to demand their verdict.
"No, of course he is not sick, and does not mean to be so far as I can tell," Keynes said. "I will say no more at present. We have work to do."
And went away, leaving Lawrence almost ill himself with reaction. He felt a man who had stepped out of the shadow of the gallows, 2 weeks of anxious dread giving way quite suddenly to this almost shattering relief. It was very difficult not to yield to the force of his emotions, with Temeraire saying,
"It is not very nice to be cut open, and I do not see what good it will do at all,"
nosing experimentally at the tiny, seared-shut wound, and then nudging him in alarm.
"Lawrence?" "Lawrence, pray do not worry. It does not hurt so much, and look, it has already stopped bleeding."
Jane was writing papers before Keynes had half made her his report, her face lit with energy and purpose, the grey shroud of sorrow and weariness fully visible only now with its removal.
"Let us not have any rioting, if you please,"
Keynes said almost angrily. His hands were still gory with blood crusted under the fingernails. He had come straight from his work in making comparisons of the samples of blood beneath his microscope.
"There is no justification for it.
It may very well be merely a difference in physiognomy, or an individual trait. I have said only there is the merest possibility worthy of a trial, worthy of a small trial with no expectations. His protests were useless. She did not pause for a moment. He looked as though he would have liked to snatch away her pen.
Nonsense! A little riot is just what we need, Jane said without even looking up. And you will write the most damned encouraging report ever seen, if you please. You will give no excuses to the Admiralty.
I'm not speaking to the Admiralty at present, Keynes said, and I do not care to give unfounded hopes. In all likelihood, he has never had the disease. It is some natural resistance unique to his breed, and the cold which he suffered last year merely coincidence. The hope was indeed a very tenuous one. Semeraire had been ill en route to China, briefly, the sickness settling itself out of hand after little more than a week in Cape Town, and so dismissed at the time and afterwards as a mere trifling cold. Only his present resistance to the disease had given Keynes the suspicion that the illnesses might perhaps have been one and the same. But even if he were not mistaken, there might be no cure. If there were a cure, it might not be easily found. If it were found, still it might not be brought back in time to save many of the sick. And it is by no means the least likely possibility, Keynes added peevishly, that there may be no curative agent whatsoever. Many a consumptive has found a temporary relief in warmer climes.
Whether the climate, or the waters, or the food, I do not care two pins. If I must ship every dragon in England to Africa by boat to take the cure, you may be sure I will do it, Jane said. I'm almost as glad to find some cause to lift our spirits again as for the chance of a cure, and you will do nothing to depress them again.
Little hope riches enough to those who until lately had none, and worth pursuing with every means at hand.
Lawrence, you and Temeraire must go, though I hate to give you up again, she added,
handing him his orders, hastily written and scarcely legible.
But we must rely on him to remember best whatever might have suited his taste, and be the foundation of the cure. The Ferrels come along as well as could be hoped, thank heavens, and with this latest spy captured, perhaps we will be lucky, and Bonaparte will not be in such a hurry to send good dragons after bad.
And I am sending along all your formation, she continued. They are in urgent need, having been among the first to take sick. If you bring them back, well, which, God willing, you can hold the channel while we treat the others.
Then I may see Maximus and Lily again now, Temeraire said jubilantly, and would not wait, but insisted that they go at once.
They had scarcely sat down outside the barren clearing where Maximus slept before Barclay came striding out to them and, seizing Lawrence by the arms, nearly shook him, saying ferociously,
"For God's sake, say it is true, and not some damned fairy tale!"
And he turned aside and covered his face when Lawrence gave his assent. Lawrence pretended not to see.
"Temeraire, I believe your harness is loose there over the left flank. Will you look at it?"
he said firmly, when Temeraire would have kept peering at Barclay's bowed shoulders.
"That Mr. Fellows was working on it only last week," Temeraire said, diverted, nosing over it experimentally.
He delicately took up a bit of the harness between his teeth and tugged on it.
"No, it lies perfectly well. It does not feel the least bit loose at all."
"Here, let's have a look at you,"
Barclay interrupted brusquely, having mastered himself.
"A good 12 feet more since you sailed away to China, no? And you look well, Lawrence. I expected to see you ragged as a tinker."
"You would certainly have found me so when we had first returned," Lawrence answered, gripping his hand.
He could not return any compliment. Barclay had put off some 6 stone of weight at first glance, and it did not suit him. His jowls hung loose from his cheeks. Maximus looked still more dreadfully altered, the great scaly red and gold hide sagging in folds around the base of the neck, and forward of his chest, with the massive fretwork of his spine and shoulders holding it up like tent poles, and what Lawrence supposed to be the air sacs swollen and bulging from his wasted sides. His eyes were slitted nearly shut, and a thin, raspy noise of breathing issued from his cracked open jaws, a trail of drool puddling beneath them. The nostrils were caked over with dried, flaking effluvia.
"He will wake up in a bit, and be glad to see you both," Barclay said gruffly. "But I don't like to wake him when he can get any rest. The blasted cold will not let him sleep properly, and he don't eat a quarter of what he should."
Temeraire, having followed them into the clearing, made no sound, but crouched himself down, his neck curved back upon itself like a wary snake, and sat there, utterly still, his wide, unblinking gaze fixed on Maximus, who slept on, rasping, rasping. Lawrence and Barclay conversed in low voices, discussing the sea voyage.
"Less than 3 months to the Cape," Lawrence said, "to judge by our last voyage, and we had some fighting off the Channel to see us off, which did not speed matters."
"However long, better on a ship to some purpose than lying about like this, if we all drown at it," Barclay said. "We will be packed by morning, and the lummox will eat properly for once if I have to march the cows down his gullet."
"Are we going somewhere?"
Maximus said sleepily, in a voice much thickened, and turned his head aside to cough, low and deep several times, and spit into a small, leaf-covered pit dug for the purpose. He rubbed each of his eyes against his foreleg in turn to clear away the mucus, and then, seeing Temeraire, slowly brightened, his head rising.
"You are back. Was China very interesting?"
he asked.
"It was. Oh, it was, but—" Temeraire burst out. "I am sorry I was not at home while all of you were sick. I am so very sorry,"
and hung his head miserably.
"Why, it is only a cold,"
Maximus said, only to be interrupted by another bout of coughing, after which he added regardless,
"I will be perfectly hearty soon, I am sure. Only I am tired."
He closed his eyes almost directly he had said this, and fell again into a light stupor.
"They have the worst of it,"
Barclay said heavily, seeing Lawrence away. Temeraire had crept very quietly out of the clearing again, so they might go aloft without disturbing Maximus.
"All the regal coppers. It is the damned weight. They do not eat, so they cannot keep up their muscle. And then one day they cannot breathe. 4 lost already, and Litificat will not see summer unless we find your cure."
He did not say that Maximus would follow soon after, if not precede her. He did not need to.
"We shall find it," Temeraire said fiercely. "We shall, we shall, we shall."
"I hope to find you well, and your charge, when we return,"
Lawrence said, shaking Granby's hand. Behind him a great bustle and commotion were underway as the crew made their final preparations. They would depart tomorrow on the evening tide, the wind permitting, and needed to be well aboard by morning with so many dragons and their crews to be stowed. Emily and Dyer were busily folding his clothing into his battered old sea-chest, which had only just survived their most recent voyage, and Ferris was saying sharply,
"Don't think I do not see you with that bottle, Mr. Allen. You may pour it out directly, do you hear?"
He had a great many new men aboard, replacements for the unhappy number of his crew who had been lost in their year's absence. Jane had sent them all on trial for his approval, but in the torment and anxiety of the past 2 weeks, and the heavy work of those before, he had grown only indifferently acquainted with them. Now, suddenly, there was no more time, and he must make do with whomever had been given him. He was not a little sorry to be making his farewells to a man whose character he knew and understood, and upon whom he would have been happy to rely.
"I expect you will find us all to pieces," Granby said, "with half of England on fire, and Arcady and his lot celebrating in the ruins roasting cows. It will be wonderful otherwise."
"Tell Arcady from me that they are all to mind properly,"
Temeraire said, craning his head over carefully so as not to dislodge the harness-men scurrying upon his back,
"and that we will certainly be back very soon, so he need not think he has everything all to himself, even if he does have a medal now,"
he finished, still disgruntled. They were prolonging their conversation over a cup of tea when a young ensign came for Lawrence.
"Begging your pardon, sir, but there is a gentleman to see you at the headquarters,"
the boy said, and added in tones of amazement,
"A black gentleman!"
So a very puzzled Lawrence had to say his last farewells more abruptly, and go. He came into the officers' common room. There was no difficulty in picking out his guest, although Lawrence struggled for a moment before recalling his name. Reverend Erasmus, the missionary whom Wilberforce had presented to him at the party 2 weeks before. Had it been so short a time?
"You are very welcome, sir, but I am afraid you find me at 6s and 7s. Lawrence said, beckoning to the servants who had not yet brought him any refreshment. "We are leaving port tomorrow. A glass of wine?"
"Only a cup of tea, I thank you,"
Erasmus said. "Captain, I knew as much. I hope you will forgive me for descending on you at such a time without notice.
I was with Mr. Wilberforce this morning when your letter of apology arrived, informing him you were bound for Africa, and I have come to beg you for passage."
Lawrence was silent. He had every right, as a point of etiquette, to invite some number of guests, this being the prerogative of dragon captains aboard a transport as much as that of the captain of the ship herself, but the situation was not a simple one, for they would travel on the Allegiance, under a captain who, though one of Lawrence's dearest friends, and indeed his former first officer, owed no small portion of his fortune to his family's substantial plantations in the West Indies, manned by slaves. Erasmus himself, Lawrence realized with a sinking feeling, might even once have toiled in their very fields. He believed some of Riley's father's holdings were in Jamaica. Aside from all the discomfort which any strong difference of politics among shipmates might ordinarily engender, in the close quarters of a journey, Lawrence had on previous occasions failed to conceal his sentiments towards the practice, and some ill-feeling had unhappily resulted. To now inflict upon Riley a passenger whose very presence would seem a silent and unanswerable continuation of their argument had the look of a calculated insult.
"Sir," Lawrence said slowly, "I believe you said you had been taken from Luanda. We are bound for Cape Town, far to the south. It will not be your own nation." "Beggars cannot be choosers, Captain," Erasmus said simply, "and I have only been praying for passage to Africa. If God has opened a path for me that leads to Cape Town, I will not refuse it."
He made no further appeal, but only sat expectantly, his dark eyes levelled steadily across the table.
"Then I am at your service, Reverend,"
Lawrence said, as of course he had to.
"If you can only manage to be ready in time, we cannot miss the tide." "Thank you, Captain,"
Erasmus rose and shook his hand vigorously.
"Have no fear. In hopes of your consent, my wife has already been making our arrangements, and by now will already herself be on the road with all our worldly substance. There is not much of it," he added. "Then I will hope to see you tomorrow morning," Lawrence said, "in Dover Harbour."
The Allegiance stood waiting for them in the cold, sunny morning, looking oddly squat, with her masts stubby and bare, the topmasts and yards laid out upon the deck, and the enormous chains of her best bower and kedge anchors stretching out from the water, groaning softly as she rocked on the swell. She had come into harbour some 4 weeks earlier, Lawrence and Temeraire having reached England in the end scarcely any sooner than their ocean passage would have brought them, if they had sailed home with the Allegiance after all.
"You may not complain of your delays. I am too happy to find you alive and well, and not skeletons in some Himalayan pass,"
Riley said, shaking his hand eagerly in welcome, nearly before Lawrence had stepped off Temeraire's back.
"And you brought us home a fire-breather after all. Yes, I could scarcely help but hear of her. The Navy is bursting with the news, and I believe the ships on blockade take it in turn to go past Guernsey and watch her flaming away that old rock-heap through their glasses. But I am very happy we shall make shipmates again now," he continued. "And though you will be more crowded, I hope we will make shift to see you all comfortable. You are a party of seven this time?"
He spoke with so much earnest friendliness and concern that Lawrence was stricken with a sense of dishonesty, and said abruptly,
"Yes, we are a full complement, and, Captain, I must tell you, I have brought a passenger along with his family. He is a missionary bound for the Cape, and applied to me only yesterday afternoon. He is a freedman."
He regretted his words as soon as he had spoken. He had meant to make the introduction more gently, and was conscious that he had let guilt make him clumsy and indelicate. Riley was silent.
"I am sorry I could not give you more warning,"
Lawrence added, in an attempt to make apology.
"I see,"
Riley said only. "Of course you may invite anyone whom you wish," very shortly, and touching his hat went away without further conversation. He made no pretense of courtesy to Reverend Erasmus when that gentleman came aboard a little later that morning, neglecting even a greeting which would have offended Lawrence on the part of any guest, much less a man of the cloth. But when he saw the minister's wife left sitting in the small and pokey boat which had been sent for them, with her two small children and no offer made to rig a bosun's chair over the side to bring them aboard, he had had enough.
"Ma'am,"
he said, leaning over the side,
"pray be easy, and only keep hold of the children. We will have you aboard in a moment. I beg you will not be alarmed."
And straightening, said,
"Temeraire, will you lift that boat up, if you please, so the lady may come aboard?"
"Oh, certainly, and I will be very careful," Temeraire said,
and leaning over the side of the ship, well balanced to her other side by Maximus, still prodigious in weight despite his reduced state, he seized the boat carefully in one enormous forehand and plucked it dripping from the water. The boat's crew were loud in their protestations of alarm, while the two little girls clung to their stoic-faced mother, who did not permit herself to look at all anxious. The entire operation scarcely covered the space of a moment, and then Temeraire was setting the boat upon the dragon deck. Lawrence offered his hand to Mrs. Erasmus. She silently accepted, and having climbed down, reached in herself to lift out the children one after another, and then her own portmanteau and satchel. She was a tall, stern-faced woman, more substantial in build and considerably darker of skin than her husband, with her hair pinned severely down under a plain white kerchief. Her two small daughters, in perfectly white pinafores, having been admonished briefly to stay quiet and out of the way, clutched each other's hands tightly.
"Roland, perhaps you will see our guests to their cabin," Lawrence said to Emily quietly,
hoping her presence might comfort them. To his regret, it was time to give over any attempt to conceal her sex. The progression of a year and more having its natural consequences upon her figure, which bid fair to take after her mother's, it would soon be quite impossible anyone should be deceived, and he must henceforth simply brazen out any challenge, hoping for the best. Thankfully, in the present case, it could not signify what the Erasmuses should think of her or the Corps, as they were to be left securely behind in Africa.
"There is nothing to be afraid of,"
Emily informed the girls blithely as she led them away, seeing their stares.
"At least not the dragons, although we had some terrific storms on our last sea voyage."
Which left them as easy in their minds as they had been. They looked very meek as they followed her below to their quarters. Lawrence turned back to Lieutenant Franks, commanding the boat's crew, who had gone silent, having been set down amidst seven dragons, even if these were mostly sleeping.
"I'm sure Temeraire would be happy to put the boat back in her traces," he said.
But when that young man only stammered miserably, a pang of guilt made him add,
"But perhaps you have another return to make."
And on Franks's relieved assent had Temeraire set the boat back down into the water. He then went himself below to his cabin, much reduced from the previous voyage, as the space was now divided with six other captains. But he had been given a forward room, with a share of the bow windows, and it was better than many a cabin he had endured in the Navy. He did not have to wait long. Riley came and knocked, unnecessarily as the door was standing open, and begged the favour of a word.
"That will do, Mr. Dyer," Lawrence said to the young runner, presently ordering his things. "Pray go see if Temeraire needs anything. Then you may attend to your lessons,"
as he wanted no audience. The door was shut. Riley began stiffly.
"I hope you are settled to your satisfaction."
"I am."
Lawrence did not mean to begin the quarrel. If Riley wished to stand upon the point, he might do so.
"Then I am sorry to say," Riley said, not looking very sorry, only pale with anger, "I am very sorry to say that I have received a report which I could scarcely credit if I had not seen with my own eyes."
He was not speaking loudly yet. The door swung open in the middle of his sentence, and Catherine Harcourt looked in.
"Pray forgive me," she said, "but I have been trying to find you these 20 minutes, Captain Riley. This ship is too damned large. Not that I mean to complain of her in the least, of course. We are very obliged to you indeed for our passage."
Riley stammered a vague, polite reply, staring very fixedly at the top of her head. He had not known her for a woman at the time of their first meeting, which had encompassed little more than a day, and that the day after a battle. Catherine was of a slimmer stature than Jane, and with her hair pulled back snugly in her customary plait, her wide pleasant face, with its snub nose freckled and brown with sun and wind, she might more easily be mistaken by the unsuspecting. But the general secret had slipped out during their previous voyage to China, and Riley had been very much shocked and disapproving at the intelligence.
"And I hope you are comfortably... that your cabin," he said now, at a loss for the form of address. "Oh, my bags are stowed. I suppose I will find them sometime,"
Harcourt said briskly, either unconscious or deliberately blind to Riley's awkward constraint.
"That makes no never mind. It is these tubs of oiled sand for Lily to rest her head upon. I'm very sorry to have to trouble you, but we are quite at a loss where they are to be stowed. We must have them near the dragon deck in case she should have a fit of sneezing, and we must change them out quick."
as the acid of a long wing was perfectly capable, unchecked, of eating through an entire ship, straight down to the hull and sinking her, this topic naturally engaged all the interest which could be imagined of the ship's captain, and Riley answered her with energy, his discomfort forgotten in the practical concern. They settled it that the tubs should be stored in the galley, directly below the dragon deck, and this decided, Catherine nodded and thanked him, adding, "Will you dine with us tonight?" An inconvenient friendliness, but of course her prerogative. To make a technical point of the matter, she was Lawrence's superior officer. As formally their assignment remained to form a part of Lily's formation, although Temeraire had operated under independent orders now for so long that Lawrence himself scarcely remembered the fact. But it was delivered informally, at least, so it did not seem offensive when Riley said, "I thank you, but I must be on deck tonight, I am afraid." A polite excuse, which she accepted on its face, and, nodding her farewells, left him alone with Lawrence once again. It was awkward to resume, with the first natural impulse of anger thus blunted, but with a will they rose to the occasion, and after only a few more moderate exchanges, Riley's, "And I hope, sir, that I need never again see the ship's crew or her boats subjected to, I am sorry to call it so, outright interference, under not only the permission, but the encouragement," progressed very neatly to Lawrence's reply.
"And for my part, Captain Riley, I would be glad to never again be witness to such a positive disdain, not only for all the generally understood requirements of courtesy, but for the very safety of her passengers from the crew of one of His Majesty's vessels. I will not say deliberate insult."
They were soon in such fine form as might be expected from two men both in the habit of command and of full voice, whose former acquaintance made it no difficulty to touch upon such subjects as might provoke the most dramatic reaction.
"You cannot claim," Riley said, "not to have a proper understanding of precedence in these matters. You can make no such excuse. You know your duty perfectly well. You set your beast deliberately onto the ship's crew without permission. You might have asked for a chair if you wished one slung."
"If I had imagined that such a request needed to be made, upon what I had supposed to be a well-run ship when a lady was to come aboard,"
Lawrence said.
"I suppose we must mean a little something different by the term," Riley retorted, sarcastic and quick.
He at once looked heartily embarrassed when the remark had escaped him. But Lawrence was in no way inclined to wait for him to withdraw, and said angrily,
"It would grieve me indeed to be forced to impute any ungentlemanlike motive, any selfish consideration which might prompt a gentleman to make remarks so nearly intolerable upon the character and respectability of a clergyman's wife and a mother, wholly unknown to him, and therefore offering no grounds whatsoever to merit his scorn, save perhaps as an alternative preferable to the examination of his own conscience."
The door flung open without a knock. Barclay thrust his head into the cabin. They stopped at once, united in appalled indignation at this perfect disregard for privacy and all shipboard etiquette. Barclay paid no attention to their stares. He was unshaven and gaunt. Maximus had passed an uncomfortable night after his short flight aboard, and Barclay had slept no more than his dragon. He said bluntly,
"We can hear every damned word on deck. In a moment Temeraire will pull up the planking and stick his nose in. For God's sake, go knock each other down somewhere quietly and have done."
This outrageous advice, more suitable for a pair of schoolboys than grown men, was not heeded, but the quarrel was necessarily ended by the open reproof. Riley begged to be excused and went away at once.
"I must ask you to go between for us with Captain Riley, I'm afraid, henceforth,"
Lawrence said to Catherine some time afterwards, when his temper had been as much relieved as could be managed by the violent pacing of the narrow length of his cabin.
"I know we agreed I should manage it, but matters have arisen so that—"
"Of course, Lawrence, you need say nothing more,"
she interrupted in practical tones, leaving him in some despair of the discretion of all his fellow aviators. It was such a settled part of his understanding of shipboard life that one should pretend not to have heard even what of necessity had been perfectly audible that he hardly knew how to answer their frankness.
"And I will give him a private dinner instead of making it a common one with all of us, so there will be no difficulty. But I am sure you will make up the matter in a trice. What is there worth arguing about when we have 3 months of sailing together ahead of us, unless you mean to entertain us all with the gossip of the thing?"
Lawrence did not in the least like to form the subject of whispers, but he drearily knew her optimistic hopes to be ill-founded. No unforgivable remarks had been made, but many unforgettable ones, a good number by himself, he was sorry to recall, and if they did not need for honour's sake to avoid one another entirely, he felt they could hardly be on such terms of camaraderie as they had formerly known ever again. He wondered if he was to blame, perhaps for continuing too much to think of Riley as his subordinate, if he had presumed too far on their relationship. He went to sit with Temeraire as the ship made ready to weigh anchor, the familiar old shouts and exhortations strangely distant from him, and he felt a disconnect from the life of the ship such as he had never expected to know, almost as though he had never been a sailor at all.
"Look there, Lawrence," Temeraire said, south of the harbour. A small, ragged knot of dragons could be seen winging away from the covert,
towards Cherbourg, Lawrence guessed, by their line of flight. His glass was not to hand, and they were little larger than a flock of birds at the distance, too far to make out their individual markings, but as they flew, one among them briefly fired out a small, exuberant tongue of flame, yellow-orange hot against the blue sky. Iskiaka set out with a handful of the ferals, for the first time on a real patrol, the measure of the desperate circumstances which they left behind.
"Are we not leaving soon, Lawrence?" Temeraire asked. He was painfully impatient to be under way. "If we would make better speed, I would be very happy to pull at any time."
And he turned to look at Dulcia, presently lying in an uneasy sleep upon his back, coughing miserably every so often without even opening her eyes. She and Lily, who lay with her head half buried up to the bone spurs in a great wooden tub full of sand, were yet in much better state than the rest of the formation. Poor Maximus had made the flight to the ship in easy, short stages, and even so with much difficulty. He had been given all the far side of the dragon deck and was sleeping there already, heedless of the furious bustle around him as the last of the preparations to launch them commenced. Nitidus lay sprawled in exhaustion, tucked against Maximus's side, where once the Pascal's Blue would have lain comfortably on his back, and Immortalis and Messoria, huddled to either side of Lily in the middle of the deck, were grown a sort of pale lemon yellow, like milk custard.
"I could drag out the anchors in a trice, I am sure, much quicker,"
Temeraire added. The topmasts had been sent up, and the yards, and they were warping up to the kedge. Fully 400 men or more could heave on the massive quadruple capstan at once, and all of them would be needed to bring up the massive weight of the best bower. The sailors on deck were most of them already stripped to the waist, despite the cold morning, to get about it. Temeraire certainly could have provided material aid, but Lawrence was under no illusion how such an offer would presently be received.
"We would only be in the way," he said. "They will manage quicker without us."
He laid his hand on Temeraire's side, looking away from the labour in which they could have no part, to the open ocean ahead.